Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mark, that was a really interesting podcast that we had with Sam Udani last week.
Yeah, Sam shared a lot of information. Some of it was controversial, such as what he thinks is going to happen in the near term, as well as the short-term and medium-term effects on the EB5 market, not just in the next few months, but the next few years. And yeah, we challenged him on a few of those assumptions, and I think everyone came away with some insight.
What was really interesting were a few points that he made post-podcast, which I don't think you actually captured. Right, Rebecca?
Correct. It was very interesting to hear his point of view of what he's seeing with investors, how they're going about choosing projects.
Well, the big news that he brought out, which quite frankly we are seeing also, is that supply is running out. We're finding out from our projects that they really are filling up and that there's so many investors who had been out there who have basically been spending a lot of time researching, and now they're going back to their first choice. But unfortunately, the first choice no longer has investor spots.
Exactly. And not even their first choice. We're looking at, you know, their second and third choices that are being filled up as well. So now they're coming down to their fourth or fifth choices.
And the other thing is that projects are doing first come, first serve. So the investors who have not done their source of funds and are just going for the projects first are worrying because their source of funds are taking longer. And here we really can't rush it. If their source of funds is not ready, it's not ready.
Exactly. And I think that's where a lot of investors are making the mistake. I think that instead of just looking for the project first and trying to figure out which project to invest in, the investors should actually do their source of funds simultaneously as they're choosing their projects, especially with the deadline coming along right now. And even though their first, second choices are gone, it's not to say that there aren't good projects out there still.
Well, Rebecca, it sounds like we're going to jump into some tips for some last-minute EB5 investors.
Yes, Mark, you are right. We are talking about tips here. And then talking about that, we are actually in a very unique position here because there are not a lot of firms who do both project work and then individual investor work. Personally, I feel if you don't really do project work, you can't have a different or I would say a higher level of understanding of EB5.
Yes, exactly. And for us, this is Rebecca. You know, we have malpractice insurance that's really high. That's because we are doing both project and source of funds. And investors, we would say that you should check with your filing attorney. See if they do have that, if they're covered under EB5. They should be. You know, you want to make sure that the projects and your source of funds are being taken care of.
Yeah, but there are still plenty of good projects out there, though, guys. And I think that when an investor's first choice really doesn't come through and they start looking at alternatives, there is a panic which is we're starting to see setting in. And I'd just like to assure everybody that take a deep breath. There are still projects out there, but there are areas that you should look at. There are possible mistakes that we have seen. And one of the first things is, well, we've seen a number of new petitions coming in. Petitions really that you would have expected to have been put together perhaps months ago, because it does take months to put offering documents together. So projects are putting offering documents together in literally 2 weeks. That leads to another issue, skeletal filings.
Skeletal offerings.
Sorry, skeletal offerings.
Spooky, scary skeletons this month of October. Yeah, we mentioned that a couple episodes ago, the skeletal filings.
We did mention skeletal filings. So skeletal filings relates to source of funds filings. When an investor, it comes to an attorney right at the end and he doesn't have time to get all his documents together and they put less than what is required and hope that an RFE will come by and give them the opportunity to supplement their filing. USCIS are making sure that this does not happen anymore because they have already stated that skeletal filings will receive a direct denial. What we are referring to, Mark, is not skeletal filing, but a skeletal offering documents. Hermione, perhaps you would like to explain.
Yeah, so Mark, you already know, when it comes to I-526 petitions, there is the project side and there is the individual investor source of funds side. So when we are talking about skeletal offerings, we are referring to the project side. In light of time, because we are really pressed for time, a lot of projects, they are scrambling in the sense of just putting together whatever they have or they might not have. For example, a project might actually need a lease or real estate deed to actually have ground up construction, and they might not even have real estate closing.
Right. So we thought that we would spend a few minutes on discussing what you should look for in a project. Because right now, where we know that the emphasis has been to pick up a PPM and look and see what's in the PPM, as well as discuss some of the other pointers that are coming up time and time again. For example, is there an exemplar petition approved, rather an approved exemplar petition?
Yes, we get that question all the time.
Well, what is an exemplar petition, Rebecca?
So an exemplar petition is not necessarily, there's the exemplar petition to show that this project is approvable and without the investor filing. So the actual filing will go with the investors with their source of funds. The exemplar is filed beforehand to give kind of a pre-approval of the project. What we're seeing with those types of petitions, it was great maybe 10 years ago when USCIS were approving these in 6 months. We're not seeing that today. Unfortunately, we have seen exemplar petitions taking
two plus years
to get approved. You're getting the actual filings approved prior to the exemplar petition. So in my opinion, I feel it's unnecessary at this moment to have an exemplar approval.
Well, the other thing is with petitions where they have an exemplar petition, number one, you know that it's at least an offering which is over 2 years old. But more importantly, we have seen RFEs come in even when there's an exemplar petition.
Yeah, so supposedly with an exemplar petition, you are putting deference to all the petitions filed afterwards, after the approval of the exemplar. But then because, well, what Mona just said, we are actually seeing USCIS even issuing RFEs and noise after you get an exemplar approval. So basically making the exemplar approval kind of unnecessary.
Right. So guys, projects in the market, what do we want to look for? What are the possible mistakes? One of the things that we have always suggested to our investors that they should look for projects where the actual project managers have experience in the industry.
Yeah, so when we are talking about track record, right, because that's the first thing investors look at. A track record can be actually in another industry sector the developer previously did some projects on. This, of course, has relevance because you can see that they have success before. But when we are talking about the particular industry sector or the particular field they are doing a new project on, that they might be completely newbies.
Right. And we've actually discussed this on a podcast earlier when we discussed projects relating to senior housing. If senior housing is such a specialized area that if somebody is doing it for the first time without knowledge of how to, for example, continually get clients or guests, then they will run out eventually of inventory, etc. What would they do? So that's just one example.
And there is licensing and permits concerns as well.
Right. And USCIS are looking at their management and coming back and questioning them. We have seen that.
Yes, we have. And they are really digging into their past history.
Right. So if, for example, someone who is, let's say, for example, they're a doctor in their day job and they decide they're going to do an EB5 project of opening up a telecommunications store. For example, USCIS have come back and said, what experience do you have doing
this?
And then USCIS has even come back saying someone claiming they have years of real estate experience, but then their real estate experience is only investor experience, not managing experience.
So
USCIS actually questioned that as well. So what kind of capacity do you have to actually manage this new project?
That's a very, very good point, Hermione. Hermione, with regards to TEA, we're going to discuss this. Mark, we're going to discuss TEA later because I know people are now thinking they don't have time to file before the new rules. So we do need to discuss the TEA. There are people out there who are wondering whether or not it affects them if they file in a project and the TEA we know will change.
Right. So here we are talking about pre-November 21st. And then even with that, Mark, you probably already know, high unemployment TEAs, the TEA designation letter is only good for a year. So afterwards, every year you basically have to get a renewal. And then some states actually have changed their TA rules and make it super stringent to actually get a new TA designation. And some projects, I don't know whether they are thinking they should take a chance or something, but then they are trying to actually get by and file new investors under the old TA letters, which are already expired.
Right. Yeah, that's going to be a big problem. And TEA letters are taking a long time to come right now.
Yes. For example, New York State, now it actually takes several weeks. Previously, it's only a day or two.
At one time, it was a few hours. But Rebecca, location is so important for the viability of a project.
It really is. And it all depends on, you have to look at the project. You know, real estate is huge. So in New York, you know, you understand why a lot of people want to invest in real estate in New York, in California, in the big cities, versus the smaller rural areas. And, you know, hence the changes that are coming to us. So location is a very big deal.
So compare a condo project in Kansas City and a condo project in, say, the Gold Coast of New Jersey.
Exactly. You know, you have to look at the two completely different locations, but you look at the population, you look at, you know, all of that will entail which, you know, can I fill my project or will my condos get filled? Not for EB-5, but for will I be able to run this business or this project and be able to get my payments back ultimately at the end of the day?
Well, I bring the condo issue up for a reason. Whenever we've looked at hotels, 99.9% of the time, the hotels do pay back via refinance. They don't sell. And condo projects always sell. But there are different ways of handling. Sometimes the developer wants to sell the building as soon as it's built. Sometimes developers are a little bit more savvy and they want to rent it out and then sell it so they can get a higher price. And that is another reason why location is so important. I'm not saying that projects in Kansas City will not be good, but the population density in Kansas City is not going to match the population density for that requirement in, say, New York City.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so we're looking at what investors should look at for projects, whether they're new projects or old projects. And of course, management and experience is important. Location is important. Capital stack, Hermione. How important really is the capital stack?
I would say it's like super, super important.
Well, depends on the project.
Yes, that is true. For example, a hotel project, you do need a senior construction loan to actually get it started, or like a bridge finance. If you don't have senior financing, it doesn't look like the project would actually take on.
Well, this is important only, or I would say especially, if a project hasn't even started. And there are lots out there. We know for a fact there are a ton of real estate projects which are looking for investors and they haven't begun. Some of them don't even have the starting permit. So I really feel that if someone is looking at a real estate project, has it begun? If it hasn't begun, are there permits? If there are not, it's a more riskier bet. Because forget your return of capital. If that project isn't even built, you don't get your green card.
Exactly. Mona, Hermione, what about a letter of intent?
A letter of intent is there when you can't find anything else. But I personally do not, at this late stage where there are projects out there where they've already begun, I would not go for a letter of intent.
I would say in absence of everything, a letter of intent is better than nothing.
Yeah, true.
Because we've seen projects, I mean, we get co-counseling requests all the time. We've seen projects with nothing. It's only anticipated there is a senior financing in the X amount that will come in. And later on, 1 year in, like the project still hasn't even secured senior financing. And that's a big, big red flag.
Right, right, right. What about oversight? Now we've seen projects, a lot of projects for a long time, where the manager of the NCE, where the investors put their money, and the manager of the JCE, the company which is creating the jobs, are the same.
Yes.
Now, it is a conflict, but it's getting through.
Yes, but I think oversight is one of the biggest things that we need to focus on. We were talking earlier about having the experience, you know, the managers, the developers having the experience in their field. But I also think then it's important for the manager to have experience in what they're doing and what oversight they're supposed to see.
Well, the big issue with oversight right now is redeployment. Redeployment, we're going to have many, many podcasts on that because that is such a big deal. But before somebody enters into a project and puts their investment into a project, they should understand that redeployment is going to happen.
Yeah, so that's where EB-5, you have to have experience now with the EB5, because all of that, you know, and especially with the new regulations coming in, if there's going to be, you know, compliance and integrity measures that are coming in, you want someone with the experience to be able to oversee what the projects are actually going through.
Right. But I think one of the point is that if you have the same manager of the NCE and JCE, then it's the danger here is that redeployment, which, and not just redeployment, all deals should be structured at arm's length. And you're not going to get that.
This is usually not in the EB5 context. A lot of the deals, I would say a majority of the deals in the EB5 context are not negotiated at arm's length. And then, of course, necessarily would lead to conflict of interest concerns.
This is interesting because if we were not talking about EB5, if we were just talking about business corporate law, then the arm's length issue is there.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't know why the rules go out of the window when we talk about EB5 at times.
I would feel developers have more of a say and they want to control the finances or where the money goes more tightly. So it's a legitimate concern, and conflict of interest in itself is not a violation for EB5 rules or any corporate law.
Well, it can be waived.
Yes.
And most often it is.
But then it is a legitimate concern in the sense that when it comes to redeployment, for example, if the investors in the corporate documents already drafted and executed, they do not have any say in where the money will be redeployed, then that will be actually a legitimate concern.
Right. So we should make sure that the PPM at least, or maybe the operating agreement, does give the investor the ability to have a say in the redeployment.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Which brings me to another issue. So skeletal offerings, there isn't time to do a PPM. We all know how long it takes to draft a PPM. Should we be alarmed if there is no PPM, Rebecca?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, I think it is that you should have a PPM. Investors should be looking for PPM for their sake. But we've seen plenty of projects that that have filed without a PPM.
Yeah, I would disagree with that. I would say that, you know, if there's a project which is out there securing multiple investors and there's no PPM, I think we should have be alarmed.
That depends on the raise, right? We've seen a few that we don't see a PPM where we've seen a group of guys, maybe four investors that are coming together to put a project together. You could get away without a PPM.
Maybe, but if one of the group of four is the one who really instigated everything, then they can fall out. They can have arguments.
Yeah,
have family
that's
arguments
true.
Even.
And then, mm-hmm. So this is what we get asked quite a lot. Like, when investors and developers come to us, they think if I'm only approaching my family and friends, I don't need a PPM. I would actually argue against that.
I think mm-hmm. you need it more because I feel that PPM is not just disclosure for the investor, but it's also very much a protection for the developer.
Yeah, so say if anything goes wrong, if you have a PPM, at least the investors are making informed decisions beforehand and you can't use the defense of that detrimental reliance. And when it comes to family and friends, it's more important. Why? Because if you're approaching strangers, right, then they wouldn't have this much reliance on you. But then if you're approaching family and friends, they might not understand the investment as much as a total stranger. So that's why disclosure is really, really important here. So you are not actually, I wouldn't say you are providing false or misleading information, but at least you can tell them this is what the inherent risks are.
And the SEC, do they see this as a red flag, Rebecca?
Yes, they do. They are considering it as a red flag without the PPM. So we, you know...
They consider what? They consider raising capital without a PPM.
Yes.
Red flag. It's one of the warnings they gave to investors. Yes.
Yeah.
And as we were saying before, you know, you might be thinking, oh, I'm going to put myself into expense with another PPM. But in real life, if something happens when you're raising the money, then you're going to end up in a
harder
situation.
Right, because the cost of a PPM is considerable.
From the beginning, it seems a bit high because if you're doing a raise for only, I don't know, 2 million, then it might be considerably high. But then think of the consequences in the long run. If you get sued, then you're potentially mm-hmm. paying a lot more.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But if there's no PPM, then USCIS will look at what the other offering document, which is the OA, the operating agreement. So the operating agreement we have noticed lately has been heavily scrutinized line by line by USCIS.
That's definitely true. And USCIS is reading these documents with a holistic view that they are trying to see if there's any discrepancy in the agreement itself and if there's any provision they can interpret as a redemption.
Right.
So this is very important, even with investors saying, oh, it's just another corporate document. And then I can sometimes people say to us that I can just get one downloaded online. It's really not the case.
No, not at all. Because operating agreements downloaded online are not EB5 compliant. That's, no. We know that. Yeah. And the operating agreement also, I often feel, is overlooked by attorneys who might be doing EB5 for the first time, and they really do not have the familiarization with corporate documents. It's always a good idea to get someone else to step in for these type of documents.
There's also the issue of EB5 compliance, like just following up on what Marina just mentioned. Because a normal operating agreement, a standard operating agreement, will not have IA29 redemption concerns. For example, a limited liability company, the members may be able to withdraw or transfer their interest. But then for EB5, that's a legitimate concern because of redemption, like what we just mentioned.
Right. There's a lot of investors out there who are working with companies who are used to raising capital through private equity. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this is the latest trend. And Mark, you know, we've had people discussing private equity on the show as well. But private equity is very different from EB5. It starts the same, with the same offering documents, the same PPM, but and often private equity has a higher risk. But private equity ends, so to speak, after the investor has invested. There is no tracking of the money the way that you require it is required for EB5.
And then compliance is continuous for EB5.
That's correct.
And
yes.
Then for a PE deal, a private equity deal, you do not need to worry about that.
And we alluded to the whole compliance issue last week when we mentioned Senator Grassley's new bill.
Yes.
So compliance is going to be a huge big deal in the next coming, I would say, moving forward with EB5, which is a good thing.
Yeah. These investors, they're coming in for the green card purposes as well. Yeah. So that's what makes it even more so important. It's just not, they're not thinking about, I'm just losing my funds or, you know, my interests at the end of the day. It's ultimately their life goal, which was to get the green card.
Yeah. So when corporate attorneys draft a EB5 deal along with a private equity deal, they also need to think about the return on investment here is not only the monetary like return. There is also the immigration benefits as well, which is also a return on investment. It's just not as tangible, maybe as financial interest, but it's still very, very, I would say, all the well mighty. So very important.
So Mona, another issue that we're seeing is that we have projects with either no escrow at all, or if they have escrow, whether or not they're at arm's length.
Well, escrow takes time to put together. You know, if you have a proper escrow agent, which is another layer of oversight, then again, often they need the PPM, they need the final documents. And again, if you're rushing documents together, a lot of projects are like, oh, we don't need escrow, we want all the money. Escrow agents, good escrow agents, like, for example, Signature Bank, they will not release the full amount of money. They will always have a holdback. And something like Signature Bank is at arm's length. But Rebecca, this is what we have seen.
Exactly.
Attorneys and people who are not at arm's length holding escrow.
Exactly. And, you know, we're seeing this now, but it's nothing new. This has always been around. I mean, since I started here in 2011, we've been dealing with escrow issues. And you have to have a genuine arm's length person. The escrow agent, whoever that escrow agent is, cannot be or cannot have any relationship to the petitioner, the NCE, or the JCE, other than being an escrow agent. And that's why Signature Bank works. They have no relationship to any of the three parties that we just mentioned.
I hope Signature Bank is enjoying this. Listening.
But when you're seeing attorneys, when you're seeing others, or even the developers themselves are being the escrow agent, you know, that's screaming, issues.
Yeah, the other point, which is a very important, not only for the escrow account, but also for anyone who is considering partial investments, which is really talking about source of funds and not documents, but the escrow account must show that the EB5 capital is immediately and irrevocably committed to the NCE. Similarly, if you're doing partial filings, your money must be irrevocably committed. It means that if you don't raise the rest of the capital, you don't get the original capital back. It does go into the project.
I just want to add one more point. When it comes to the escrow agent, now we are talking about an impartial person. When it comes to a financial institution as well, being an escrow agent, you also need to make sure the financial institution does EB-5 and understands EB-5. Now we are seeing some projects engaging a bank that don't really understand EB-5, and they just take money from the escrow account on a continuous and regular basis. And that is a major, major red flag.
It is, it is. There, I can see a lot of issues coming up relating to, you know, non-conventional escrow moving forward. Maybe it is safer not to have escrow at all then. Yeah, well, escrow isn't actually part of the EB-5 regulations, but it does give you that feeling of oversight and that safety mechanism. One point, ladies, that was mentioned by Sam, we all discussed this, really. I'm not sure whether we talked about it in the podcast last week or whether we talked about it afterwards, is the amount of petitions in the latest quarter, which was released by USCIS, the latest data, the amount of petitions which have received denials. Now, we know this is the highest number of Indian investors who are coming into EB-5. There's a jump of more than 250%. And for the first time, we are seeing a record number of denied petitions. There is this push out in the market that we can file your petition very easily, very quickly. No, it doesn't work that way. We've emphasized this on this program over and over again. But hey, guys, 45 to 50, 48% denial rate.
Yeah, that's extremely high. And again, you know, we don't want to make the correlation, but like Mona mentioned, you know, Indian investors have jumped in the last year or so. And, you know, you have to, we discuss skeletal filings. We've discussed multiple sources. You have to be prepared. Investors have to understand as well that when you're coming in, you can't expect us to file an application within 2 days. It's not feasible when you have multiple sources, especially if you're bringing sources from different areas, different countries. You need that time to put this application together.
So, Mark, you know, we've given our guests on the show magic wands, even crystal balls. But you know what? I'm going to give you a gift of $550,000. I know you're a US citizen, but I'm going to tell you to go and make an investment, an EB-5 investment.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, so the magic ball is literally in my court. Yeah, what would I do? Honestly, I would look at projects, regional centers that are close to completing their funding, but there's still room left. I wouldn't look at the ones that still have a long way to go. I would try to find ones that they've got a few spots left. The doors are about to close and jump in there. And hope, and obviously retain a good immigration attorney, because there's a lot of uncertainty what's going to happen November 21st. I want to go ahead and say that as well. Yeah, that's what I would do. I would go with a regional center that has already completed a lot of funding, but there's still a little bit of room left before they close out.
Well, for those who want to do their own project, though, $900,000 is not something which is not doable. What we always see is that if someone is serious with their own project, then they don't do it with $500,000. They usually do it with $1 million+. Mm-hmm. So for those type of investors, I don't think the deadline really makes any difference.
Oh, well, that's good. That's good. Because honestly, if you're talking about creating your own project, that's not something you want to rush into anyway, for all the reasons that you discussed already on this particular episode and all the past ones. There's a lot to think about, so don't rush in. So that's good to know that we're already talking about the amount of money that even with the change, that may not affect it. Well, Mona, Rebecca, Hermione, thanks so much for sharing with us some last-minute tips for EB-5 investors.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.